Test, test, test. This will be an interview with Rabbi Rami Shapiro, 9450 Sunset Drive in Kendall, I believe, on storytelling. It's September 6th, 1985.
That's not where they were from, but that's where they lived.
Why don't we start then with just a little background on you? And you grew up in Massachusetts, and your grandparents, who were the ones who first introduced you to storytelling, is that right?
Sure, I learned.
Tell me a little bit about them.
Okay, my grandparents are, three of them are from the Soviet, what's now the Soviet Union, from the Russia area, and one was from England. And they came over here, in the teens, 1914, 1915, something like that. And they came over as kids. And they brought with them a whole variety of folklore. Really, that was their main baggage, I imagine, was folklore they brought from the old country over to the new country. And the way they lived actually sort of added to the folklore. They did interesting things. My grandmother from England came over, and because she was, most immigrants who came over, English was not their native language. They came over speaking Yiddish and other Eastern European languages. She came over as a native speaker of English and managed to, they all came over to New York and managed to integrate into the New York scene really easily. And she met my grandfather, who was heavy Russian-accented kind of person. And the way they grew up was, you know, a classic Lower East Side kind of existence. On the other side, that's my mother's side of the family. My grandfather worked in the laundry business. I could tell you all kinds of stories about laundry business that they went through. He was involved with gangsters. There's a fantastic headline in a New York paper. No, it was a Chicago paper. He went to visit someone in Chicago, and it was a cousin of his, and it was also in the laundry business. And just to help out, they sent him on a truck to just pick up laundry from different places. But at the time, there were what they called laundry wars, and the different companies were stealing each other's laundry. And my grandfather's cousins didn't tell him that he was going out to actually do a hit on another laundry company's business. So they went over to a place that was a normal pickup. They sent my grandfather in. He didn't know anything. Went in, took all the laundry, took it out, and when he came out, he was surrounded by these big, humongous guys who were from the other laundry company. And they demanded to know what he was doing, and they had a fight, and the police came, and they arrested my grandfather for being part of this laundry war. And the big headline in the Chicago paper, because my grandfather was from New York at that time, says, "New York gangster captured in laundry wars." It was a real, we had that. It was a big, that was the big, his big claim to fame. But they were very much acculturated, though, and real quick. Though they were first-generation immigrants, they moved rapidly out of the New York scene into the Massachusetts, where they continued in the laundry business. This is all on my mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
And became fairly lower middle class, you know, fairly rapidly. On the other side of my family, both my grandparents are from Russia. And their immigrant experience was more classic in the sense they never really outgrew it. My mother's parents became American. By the time I really knew them, they were Americans. My Bubby and Zadie, my father's parents, never really became American. They were old world Eastern European Jews without America. Just sort of, they glided over America, and they never really fit in. My grandfather was a horse trader, and my grandfather was a lot of things. He was a peddler and a horse trailer and a general fix-it man, and used to make a decent living. But his problem was he was an excellent salesman. He could sell you anything, but like most excellent salesmen, he was easily sold to as well, and was always the, what do they call it, the ringer? Or I can't remember the word now, where someone has a scam going, and they pick on a guy, and that sucker is, you know, loses out. My grandfather was the archetypal sucker. He was open to every kind of salesman and sales pitch and scam that was available. But they, primarily through the mothers, not the fathers, but the two grandmothers, they passed on the lore that they had learned. And I guess if I had to really pick who the source of the storytelling is, it would be my Bubby, my father's mother. And I can remember sitting on the couch, laying on the couch in her house, her apartment in Springfield, Massachusetts, when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12, maybe even younger than that. And she would, she knew some kind of, I guess we would call it reflexology now, but some foot massage technique. And she would take your shoes and socks off and massage your feet and then tell you stories while she was doing it. It's probably pre-Freudian therapy or something. That's what she was into. And I learned lots of stuff from her. But I guess primarily what I learned was the fun of actually telling stories. You know, I don't have the sources that she got her stories from. You know, she says they happened to someone in a village, but then, you know, how do you know? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
When I came down here, there was when I moved to Miami about 4 years ago, almost five, there was a story going around here that people I knew said happened to their best friend's neighbor about some white slave things going on at the falls, you know, people being abducted. And a couple of days later, it came out in the paper that there was a mass hysteria. Everyone was telling the story. Everyone was convinced it happened to the best friend of their neighbor. And it happened to nobody. It was just pure fiction. So you never know where these things come from.
Is that the... What times... You described one setting when she would tell you stories. Did you have other brothers and sisters?
I have a sister.
Was that the primary, setting where you would have...
Well, the primary... See, my... Yeah, I would think that's the primary setting would be her apartment, mm-hmm. because she never left. My grandfather would spend his days on a park bench. Because again, by the time I knew them, they were fairly old and they were retired. He would spend his time on the park bench speaking with his friends in Yiddish. And Yiddish is not I've studied it, but that's all. I really mm-hmm. have no fluency in the language at all. But my grandmother spent almost all of her time in her apartment, and the apartment was very heavy feeling place, very dark, very Eastern Europe. It had a smell like she imported it from Eastern Europe of all the baked goods and all that kind of stuff. And that's where she lived, you know, literally. That's where she was, like her cave. And I would spend weekends there and different things. And she never said, you know, come, let's sit down and I'll tell you a story.
Mm-hmm.
If that was just what happened. I mean, she would just talk, and that's how it came out. And really, that's what would happen. I guess as they spoke, the folklore it was so intimate a part, such an intimate part of their lives that their folklore became their own history. So that, which is why you can't separate truth from falsehood here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happened to somebody. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe they said it happened to her, and maybe yes, and maybe no. It all gets blurred, I guess, at some point. But for her, they were all real. I mean, there was no doubt about it. You know, I don't know if you know anything about the evil eye.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, she was, you know, she believed in the evil eye, and she had all the, you know, the things that you'd say and things that you'd do to ward off the evil eye. You know, she'd spit at the right place, and she'd... say the right protective phrase, and that was not even, it was totally unselfconscious. I mean, she just, that's what she did, and that was that. But that was the primary setting, is with her, I would think, more than the other grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Did your father know any of these stories, or was it mostly between you and your grandmother and not?
It's a good question. I don't know if he knows any of them. I have no idea. I've never mentioned it to him. If you know anything about the sociology of the Jewish immigrant experience, the children of the grandparents, you know, of my grandparents, rejected their culture totally. So people like my father and my mother, they just rejected their parents' immigrant culture and really became as American as possible. So we never used... For example, I was brought up totally without Yiddish. My father speaks it fluently. He speaks to his parents in Yiddish, but would never speak Yiddish in the house. Wouldn't even consider it. Not that he was trying to... He was already beyond any self-conscious attempt to keep it out of the home. He was just, it just never occurred to him that in an American family, he would speak anything other than English. And the same thing would be true about any kind of stories he would tell. The only place I got them personally, you know, as far as family goes, would be from her.
Mm-hmm.
I make it sound like she's the only one of the four. She's the primary one of the four. But they all had their stories to tell.
And then did you later go on and get some sort of training? You said that there's sort of classical stories now within the literature that are printed. Is that, are you...
Well, part of... Yeah, am I... Go ahead, I'm sorry, I cut you off. Am I trained in those?
Right. Is that part of the training that you
went to?
Well,
part of the rabbinic training,
for the
I mean, I went to the rabbinate very late. Most people go to the rabbinate into the seminary right after college, and I didn't do that. I went on for a master's degree, and then I went to, finally to the seminary after a while after that. By the time I got there, my main interest, for no reason I could actually put my finger on, was folklore.
What was your master's in?
In Jewish studies. I have a BA in Buddhist studies, and then two MAs in Judaica, and a PhD in Jewish studies.
From?
Which?
The PhD
Union in Cincinnati. And I have my ordination from Hebrew Union College. By the time I got to seminary, my main interest was Midrash, which is Hebrew folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, I suppose, major in it, in mm-hmm. a sense. And I took all the courses I could get on folklore. In Judaism, the folklore is the living tradition, really. Once, as soon as any text became codified and written down and sealed so it couldn't change, the response of the people was to write folklore based on the text so that you could keep it alive and changing. So there's more, you know, we've got the five books of the Bible, but there are just an infinite number of books of Bible stories very loosely linked to the original five books, and that's how they kept it alive. So, yeah, in seminary, I studied that material very seriously, and without any intention, though, of becoming a storyteller. That wasn't, I was going to become an academic. I really wanted to teach in the university and teach in the philosophy departments. Ended up, obviously, taking a pulpit. I didn't do that either. And when I started to work as a rabbi, and again, that wasn't my intention, but when I really went to rabbinical school because I wanted to learn about Judaism more. But when I graduated and I decided not to pursue the PhD immediately and went to get a job, I found with my very first congregation experiences that what worked best with people were the stories. And I started a tradition, which I have since lost. But when I would come, I used to live in Cincinnati and fly to Miami once a month. And whenever I came down, I'd come down with a new piece of liturgy that I'd written. And the heart of each piece of liturgy was a story. And after a while, the stories began to multiply and the liturgy got smaller. And the evenings would turn into storytelling evenings. Loosely, the stories would be loosely connected with traditional prayers so that it was a Shabbos service. But the main emphasis became the stories. And that was totally unselfconscious. It just happened. And then when I realized it happened, I began to pay more attention to that phenomenon and, you know, sort of switched over. Now we've gone away from that as far as a weekly thing and do it very consciously, you know, once a month. But it sort of just came out that way. That's how I discovered it.
Is that really the beginning of you for telling these kinds of stories in this setting you just described, or had you been doing it sort of all along?
No, it was the beginning. It was just 4 years ago. I mean, I had learned them, and they were, you know, part of my growing up, and I had studied them as a, you know, in an academic setting, and had written papers on them and published things about them, but had never even taken them as living materials that could still mm-hmm. speak to people. It was an accident. And what I found was I was using them originally the same way I used them in academic articles to make a point. You know, I wanted to say something, and simply, in addition to simply saying it didactically, there was always a folk tale that would illustrate the point more clearly. And you could see the people's faces, the shift in their consciousness, and almost, you could almost read it in their faces, that they were more awake when the stories were on than when you were simply talking to them. And what happens, I think, is that, especially now that I'm doing it with more awareness, that if you let people know that it's story, that it's a story is coming, they turn off their critical thinking, and they let, I don't know what you want to call it, a more primitive mind or a more childlike, you know, mind come on. And they're more willing to accept absurdities that a story can get away with, which allows the point the story makes to be felt much more deeply than if I simply made the point in a didactic manner. And as I became more aware of that, I discovered the power of the tale. But it was purely by accident, just about four or 5 years ago.
And you've been here in Miami full time now how long?
4 years.
4 years? At this position that you're...
I was with another synagogue. No, Temple Beth Or is 2 years old. I was with another synagogue for 2 years before that. The other one folded. It didn't make it. This one I started with 40 families. We started it ourselves. And by the time we got around to starting this, storytelling had become an integral part of what we do. And I was starting to, people knew that I told stories. In fact, I belong to this group, it's called the Snowmass Group. It meets twice a year. There are 12 people in the group. We meet in monasteries around the country. The people are, there's one representative from each of the major traditions of the world, religious traditions, and they come from all over. There's people from Tibet and people from, a woman from China, a whole variety of traditions are... The Snowmass Group, that's what we were talking about. So the purpose of the Snowmass is for the 12 of us to get together, and we try to discuss our religious traditions as they filter through our own experience. So no comparison of dogma, but comparison of religious experience. And what came out of that, we've been doing that for about 2 years. The last meeting, we went around and people said, you know, what do you do to get your message across? And, you know, each person had their thing. When it came to me, they, as a group, I mean, before I even had a chance to try to think of what I was going to say, they all said, well, he tells stories. That's what he does. And when I thought about it, or they then went on to elaborate, really, they said that it's just, that's how I do it. So over the last couple of years, that just becomes my method of teaching, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Are there, like, different types of stories that you conceptualize, that you use, like, the ones, for example, that you learned from your grandparents may fall into various classifications of types of stories, and ones that you've studied from written texts, obviously.
Yeah, there's different. They fall into different categories, I suppose.
How would you categorize them? Is that something you do consciously, or I mean, are there categories that you think of?
Well, there are categories that I was taught in seminary. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are specific categories that people put the various stories in. There are the wonder tales, which are simply to these are the ones that I would learn from, you know, my grandmother, for mm-hmm. example. Wonder tales about the great rabbis of her village mm-hmm. or her country or her area, you know. The rabbi who had the horse that could, you know, at night when no one could see it, he could travel great distances. The horse probably flew and you know, this magical kinds of tales. Mm-hmm. The rabbi who could, you know, look inside your soul and see what your past lives were and see why in this life you're suffering and how he could take you back. A la Dickens almost, and experience what you'd gone through in a past life so you could make corrections in this life and mm-hmm. break that kind of cycle of pain. Wonder tales are things that you would learn from people who lived in that kind of environment. There are tales that are legalistic. Mm-hmm. Those are there's a whole body of folk tales that make legal points. Now, those you learn in seminary. Mm-hmm. There's a whole body of theological ones that try to eliminate confusion in the Bible or elaborate on a biblical point or something like that. Those are also have a specific purpose. But the main, category of tale that I use primarily, the ones that I tell if I go out and I tell stories, are usually a variation on the wonder tale. Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing some kind of legal investigation, the other tales really are sort of secondary.
Those wonder tales ones then that you would have learned to both through your family and also learned or read?
Yeah, sure, sure. My first experience is through my family. Mm-hmm. But then once you know they exist, you sort of hunt them out to mm-hmm. find out. And then you discover variants that, you know, the rabbi with the magical white horse who lived in my grandmother's village, well, he also lived in 15 other places. Right. And you can put them all together and come up with a composite story there. But there is one Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, who lived about 150 years ago. And he was the master storyteller. And he had a whole theory of Jewish storytelling that made storytelling more than simply an entertainment. His theory, to put it in a nutshell, is that when God created the world, he created it through stories. And that he created 13 primordial tales, God did. And in the process of creation, and as people were learning the tales became corrupted, like in the game Telephone. And the more corrupted they became, the more variants we had, and it was less and less possible to discover the true tale that God had told me in the beginning. And those are all power tales. I mean, you know those stories, you can repair the world, in a sense. You know, you can make peace and harmony, etc. But over the generations, we lost them. Over the thousands and thousands of years of human existence, people have been telling these tales, each with their own twist, and we lost the original power tale. Rabbi Nachman believed that he had rediscovered the original stories, and that he then told them to his disciples, and they in turn passed them on and wrote them down, so we'd have them without, you know, we'd have God's word again, in a sense, a second Bible, but in a folktale kind of framework. That kind of story forms the basis for the ones that I tell, the ones that have a very powerful message. Mm-hmm. But I was introduced to them by my grandmother, but she, you know, she got them from the street as opposed from the source, and the sources are now available.
I see. So you perhaps do sort of a composite then?
I do a composite, you're right. I mean, I know she sort of pointed me in the right direction, and then, you know, you're limited. She was limited to what she heard when she was a little girl, I imagine she forgot more than she remembered. And then as people get more and more interested in the folklore area, folk tales, the material is being made available, and you know, I've got volumes of it. So now it's a matter of building on what, you know, she first introduced me to, right. But it's a lot more than what she originally had.
Could you give me some examples of some of these wonder tales, maybe a couple of them that you...
Okay.
At least ones that may have started with your grandmother. I know you've got your own version now, so...
Okay, I'll tell you one that I learned a long time ago that is real nice. I think it falls in the wonder tale genre, though it's not about a rabbi, it's about your archetypal, humble, poor person. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole series on those.
Did she give them titles, by the way, your grandmother?
No, she would just talk about, you know, Shlomo of whatever, you know, a town or... if they were funny stories, there's a place called Chelm, Chelm, which is not a real place. It's just a fictional place, and all crazy Jewish stories come out of Chelm. I mean, all the people there are Meshuga, and they're all crazy, and they do wild things. And when she was growing up, I mean, that was like a real place in their, you know, in their folk literature, in their mythology, anyway. But there's a story about a very poor man who lived in an equally poor shtetl, a village, who barely eked by his living. What he would do is he would go out and he would gather the kindling on the ground in the woods, and he would bring it and try to sell it to people who couldn't go out and get their own firewood, and he barely got by. One night he went to sleep, and he dreamt this dream. And in the dream, he saw himself walking this tremendous distance from his village, which was in the far borderlands of his country, to the capital. And he could see himself walking over the hills and crossing the rivers and going through all this these various terrains till he got to the capital. The capital was like a jeweled city. And he knew that in the city there was a bridge on the far side that connected the city like a moat to the outside lands. And that under the bridge there was a treasure, and that if he could get to the treasure, he would be wealthy beyond his wildest imagination. In the morning, he wakes up, and he dismisses the dream. It was just a dream. It had no significance. He dreamed crazy things. He forgot about it. Went about his day's business. He got home. He went to sleep that night and dreamt the exact same dream. And he saw himself traveling outside his village, going through all this different terrain until he got to the jeweled city, and he saw the bridge again. And underneath the bridge, he knew that there was this treasure that would make him wealthy. In the morning, he wakes up and dismisses it again. I mean, so that would happen twice. It's just coincidence. The third night, he has the exact same dream. And he sees it again very, very vividly. And he knows exactly where the treasure is. And when he wakes up in the morning, he decides that you don't dream this thing three times in a row without it being a message from God. So he locks up his little shack, and he takes what food he has, and he puts it in a sack on his back, and he goes to make this incredibly long trek to the capital city. And as in his dream, he knew exactly how to go. He forded the river, and he climbed over the mountains and made it through the forest till he got to the capital city. And it was, as it was in his dream, an absolutely jeweled city, dazzling in the sun. And he found himself on this hilltop overlooking the bridge that he knew had the treasure underneath. What was true in real life that wasn't true in his dream was that the bridge is guarded very heavily by the soldiers of the king. And every hour there'd be a changing of the guard. And he sat there all day on the hilltop and just watched to see if they ever left. Because if they would leave, he would sneak down, get the treasure, and go home. But they never left. The thing was never unguarded. He waited 3 days and finally decided there was no hope. Either he was going to go home empty-handed or perhaps he could strike a deal with the guards. So he went down and waved over the captain of the guard. The captain of the guard comes over and says, you know, what is it you're looking for here? I noticed you on the hill for 3 days. You know, what's the story? So the man says, look, I had this dream. And in my dream, I dreamt that I moved from my village to this bridge. And I've got to get underneath this bridge, because there's a treasure underneath there. And if you let me through, I'll share the treasure with you. The captain of the guard just said, that is absolutely ridiculous. He goes, you're such a jerk. He says, I have dreams all the time. If I did what my dreams told me, I'd be running all over the place. He says, last night I had a dream. I dreamt that in this village, the other end of the country, there was this poor Jew who lived in this poor hut. And the guy was an idiot. He was doing all these kinds of things, not realizing that right underneath the loose floorboard, underneath the wood burning stove in his own hut, there was this tremendous treasure. He says, if I believed that, I wouldn't be standing here guarding this stupid bridge. I would be on my way out to that village. Well, the guy realized right away that the captain had dreamt about him in his own village and that he had to get back. So he thanked the captain and said, you're right, I'm absolutely crazy about this. I'm not going to look under the bridge. I'm leaving. So he makes his way back, you know, across the river, up the mountains, to his village, goes back in the house, moves his stove, and does find the loose floorboard, digs it up, and there it is. Obviously, this huge treasure. And he becomes the most wealthy man in his whole province. He shares the money with everybody. The entire village is raised up in its economic status. And he sends the captain of the guard an anonymous gift and lives happily ever after. So that's an example of one, you know, one wonder tale. Now, when I tell it to an audience, obviously it comes out real different. But that's the plot. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something that my grandmother would have taught.
Did she just sort of tell these tales to pass away the time with you, or were there like a point she was making?
No point. No. This was her equivalent of TV. yeah, there was no point.
Right.
You wouldn't even have to. I'm trying to think if I ever actually asked her to tell them. I think that they were just part of what she did.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think, it's just a guess, but my feeling is if you actually said, you know, Bubby, tell me a story, she might not have been able to even think of one. You know, these weren't stories to her exactly. Mm-hmm. They were memories. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I know because I've read them in other versions that they are stories that she was taught. But
do you know
to her, they were
did
memories.
Did she tell you how she learned them herself?
She well, not all of them, but I from what she said, they were village tales that were just, you know, if you grew up there, you just knew them, like you knew. You know, when the rains were coming and when the crops had to be planted and all the rest of it. It was part of the air she breathed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone...
All right.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
So, I was wondering, I know, again, this is not your normal storytelling situation, but maybe you could give me an example of just, you know, at least the plots of a couple other of the stories?
Sure, there's a story, I mentioned the Chelm stories. Again, the Chelm is, it's interesting when I mentioned the snow mass group before about the different people from the various religions getting together. One of the topics we brought up at a lunch once was humor and the stories that people tell. And the question was basically, is there a, when you look to tell stories about being stupid, what ethnic group do you look to tell the stories about? So in America, we have Polish jokes. You know, what are the jokes? What's the ethnic group you pick on if you're a Buddhist? You know, like that kind of thing. And we went around the room. Everybody had a specific ethnic group that they picked on. Even a man named Grandfather Red Elk, who's a Sioux Indian medicine man, also very much into storytelling, though his stories are hard to follow because there a lot of it is not English. But he said that even the Sioux tell Crow Indian jokes, and that when they want to know how many Crow Indians it takes to screw in a light bulb, it's the same jokes. And we went around it. When it came to my turn, I couldn't think of a group. You know, the Jews adopt when they move into a culture, so I'm sure Jewish people tell Polish jokes, which is as wrong as anyone else doing it, but I mean, it's just indigenous here, so they just pick it up. But I couldn't find something indigenous to Jews. Like the Crow Indian jokes were indigenous to the Sioux. We tell jokes about other Jews. And we've sort of made a subcategory of Jew called the Jews of Chelm. And they are the people that you talk about when you want to know how many Jews it takes to screw in a light bulb. Chelm stories are of a specific type. A perfect example would be one about one group of Chelmites discovered that it was very difficult to get through their village at night because they had no lights. And there are a lot of potholes, especially in the wintertime. And it was, if you couldn't see, it was very dangerous to be on the streets because you would step into things and hurt yourself. The only time it was safe to go out was when there was a full moon, because the moon lit up the way and you could see where you're going and avoided the potholes. So they decided what they should do is capture the moon and then use the moon's light to illuminate the village for the rest of the month. So they couldn't figure out how to do it. They had a town meeting. They talked about climbing up and putting a rope around it, and obviously nothing was going to work until they realized that when it rained, the moon could be seen in the puddles on the ground. So they realized that if the moon comes down to earth when it rains. So they set up a big barrel which trapped rainwater, and they waited to the next full moon, and the reflection of the moon was caught in the rain barrel. Unfortunately for the Chelmites, they didn't know a reflection from the real thing. They thought it was the moon. They covered it over with a blanket. They tied it up, put chains around it, and dragged the thing into a barn to keep it. And when the full moon passed and it was getting darker and darker in the streets, they couldn't see, they brought the barrel out and undid the chains, undid the ropes, pulled off the blanket in an attempt to let the moonlight fill the rest of the village and light the way. Obviously, there was nothing in the barrel. And then the story goes on. They have this big argument, where'd the moon go? And how next time they're going to have to try a thicker blanket. So they, you know, they're all stories about absolutely ludicrous situations to show the ironic, comical side of existence. So that's a kind of tale that just, you know, that's just the plot. You know, that's just the plot line. But that's the kind of story that she would tell as jokes, you know, that kind of thing. What other kinds of stuff are you...
What about the rabbi with the...
The wife? Wonder Tales. The right. Wonder Tales.
Let me just... It's